So many passages we could go through this morning that talk about love, and we can make application to marriage. But I can't think of a better one than the one that's before us here, where we get an entire 13 verses devoted just to the definition of love. Let me read you the first part of this definition, and then we'll jump into our text here in a little bit. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all that I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, and have not love, I gain nothing. What I want to do this morning in talking about love and marriage, I want to go from problem to solution. I want to talk about where the real problem seems to lie in marriage, and then talk about how centering our lives on Christ can renew a love in marriage that maybe hasn't been there for a while, and frankly, maybe it's never been there. So let's begin with the problem. And one of the main problems we have is this: when normal is not normal. In other words, where what you could perceive to be normal is not the biblical norm. Let me kind of set the stage for this. Take someone who has a car accident. Their knee during a car accident goes up against the dashboard, and they get out of the car and they begin to limp. A few days later, that knee stiffens. And even a few days after that, the knee stiffens even more, and they take a little physical therapy, but they can't quite get it back to that lucid motion it once had. Now, at first, the pain was very distractive. Every time that person takes a step, it reminds them that something's wrong with the knee. They're aware they're limping. They're aware they're compensating for the injury. Every time they get into their car and they have to put their knee in a certain position to get into the car, they realize something's abnormal here. Something's wrong with my knee. But before long, that kind of injury just becomes part of you. You're not even aware you're limping at all. It was once very painful. The stiffness became a way of life, but you learn to compensate for it. You don't feel crippled by it. You don't feel limited by it. You actually get around quite well. And then one day, an old friend visits, a friend from long, long ago, and they look at a man like this and they say, "Man, what did you do to your knee?" And then you realize your normal isn't actually normal. And where I'm going with this is we all tend to be rocked to sleep by regularity. We're rocked to sleep by regularity. I was watching a little video done by a pastor who ministers in New York City. And a few seconds into the video, a police car went by outside the building there. And when the police car went by, the siren went on. And the siren was so loud, it covered up the pastor's voice. All I could think about is the siren. But what I found interesting is that pastor didn't even break a sentence. He didn't even flinch. He went on talking like the car never even went by to begin with. Now, I'm sure when he first moved to the city, every single sound, every single siren drew his attention. But when you're rocked to sleep by regularity, a car can go by, the siren goes on, and you don't even hear it. You know, I grew up 2 miles from Bradley International Airport, and a plane would go overhead, and I didn't even know a plane went overhead. But anybody visiting looks up and goes, "Oh my, that's going to fall on us any moment, because it looks like it's coming right down on top of you." You can be rocked to sleep by regularity. I am very concerned that there are scores of loveless marriages in our culture, and probably more than we tend to think. But even more than that, I'm concerned at the regularity of lovelessness. It's rocked us to sleep. In other words, what I'm saying is I'm concerned when a couple has a limp spiritually in love, but I'm more concerned when they don't even realize they have the limp. When it's been so many years that's just normal to them. They don't desire to be in each other's company. There's no passion. There's no intimacy. There's no trying to esteem other better than self. And they become very skilled at living that way. That's their normal. But friends, biblically, that's not normal. Because you can posture your marriage in a way to cover up the pain. And just like you can position your knee in certain ways and just get used to positioning it that way so you don't even realize something's wrong with your knee, the same can take place in marriage where you posture yourself in a way, you posture your marriage in a way where you no longer feel the pain and you're just kind of going through the motions. For example, you avoid conversations about certain things, or you avoid conversations altogether. For some, they avoid the bed altogether, or they don't go to bed at the same time, and that way they don't have to really face each other. Or they have an obligatory physical relationship. There's a limp in the relationship, but they don't realize there's a limp because it's been going on for so long. And for a lot of couples, they numb that lovelessness with children and grandchildren where the kids become the center of attention. Life revolves around the kids. You take them to soccer practice. You take them to school. You talk about the kids when the two of you are together. It looks like you have a really solid family, but in reality, talking about the kids is a way to avoid you two talking with each other about anything else. And so it looks like a very loving family since there's so much kid attention, but in reality, it can be a marriage that lacks a lot of love. Normal is not normal. We have to be careful of this. Now, what I want to do is compare two models of marriage, or two love, two, can we call, models of love in marriage. Some are building their marriage on this romantic love. We might call it an eros kind of love. And then the right way to build it, of course, is on an agape or a God-centered love. Everybody is building their marriage on one of these two models of love. We're either building it on an eros model or we're building it on an agape model. Okay? And by the way, there's four Greek words for love. I think many of you know this. There's agape love, which is a God-centered kind of love. There's phileo, which is, some say is a brotherly love. Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. There's another one called storge, which is a family love, right? And then there's eros, which many think of the word erotic. But eros is not just a sexual love. I'll explain in a minute what eros is. We'll just call that a romantic love for now. Let's compare these two models. Are we building our marriage on an eros romantic model, or are we building on an agape, a God-centered model? Now, an eros model is this, and picture this in your mind. When you think of a romantic love, don't just think of physical attraction. Think of it in this way. Two people staring at each other. And in that model, they are finding attraction in each other. That's what eros is. Eros does not mean sexual love all the time. It simply means two people that are finding attraction in each other. That's a romantic. That's an eros model. In some cases, girl looks at boy and says, wow, you know, they're really good looking. And that's eros. A boy may look back and say, wow, she's pretty. That's eros. They're looking at each other. You follow? But it can go deeper than that. It can be personality, where two people look at each other, and frankly, physically, they're not that attracted to each other, but they fall in love with each other's personality. I really love to be around this person. When we look at each other, we just click. Something's there. Something's good. That's eros. That's romance. It can be something like sense of humor, where she looks at him and says, I love his sense of humor. And he looks back and says, I love how she's so cerebral and always thinks things through. And so the eros or the romantic love is simply this. Two people looking at each other, finding attraction in each other. And let me say this. Everybody gets married because of eros. Everybody looks at someone and says, wow, there's something about that person I really like. And therefore, you, quote unquote, fall in love with them. And that leads towards marriage. Everybody pretty much connects because of eros or romance. But romance cannot keep you together. I'm sure it can bring you together, but it cannot keep you together. And here's where it gets really tricky. You may even fall in love with that other person's godliness. You can look at a person and say, I love how they're God-centered. And they can look back and say, well, I love how they always do devotions. Even that is a romantic eros. Because that is simply two people looking at each other, finding attraction in each other. Lock that model in. Now, why is that kind of romantic love doomed to failure? It's doomed to failure for at least two reasons, okay? Two reasons romantic love can bring you together but cannot keep you together. Number one, because they may change. You see, what brought you together the first time, right, was they were a really good-looking person. The reason that can't keep you together is because none of us are really good-looking for our entire life, right? I'm an example of that, you know? You know, when Tina and I were married, she used to take her hand and run it through my long, wavy, blonde hair just like this, you know? She doesn't have that privilege anymore, does she? You see, romance, that kind of romantic love where you look at the other person, they may change. Look, you married them because they're really funny, but what if they're not funny anymore? What if they start to get annoying? You married that person because they're very cerebral and they think things through. But seriously, what if they have a brain injury? You're going to stop loving them? You see, the very first reason romantic love will always break down is because they may change. The second reason it will break down is because you may change. You will change. That which you like today, you may not like tomorrow. In other words, if I could take your spouse and freeze them just like they were the day you met, what if you change your own personality and your own taste? Are you going to stop loving them? In other words, when you married him, he had a very dry sense of humor and you thought that was really funny. But what if a dry sense of humor starts to bore you? Or when you married her, physically, she looked a certain way, and therefore you were very drawn to her. But what if you change? What if something changes in that which attracts you? Here's the point. Romantic love is doomed to failure. Number one, they may change. Number two, you may change. Now, friends, let me say this. Somewhere along the way, at some point, those that are building their marriage on romantic eros kind of love, they wake up one day and they look at each other and they say, something's missing. Something that was once in our marriage, where we once looked at each other and we once had stars in our eyes, where we once couldn't stop texting each other, couldn't stop calling each other. I couldn't stop writing little messages on the mirror there when we were first married. We don't have a desire to do that anymore. Something's gone. Something's changed. Back in the book of Genesis, there's that funny little story of Jacob. Well, funny to us, not funny to him. Where without going into the ethics of it, you know, Jacob loves Rachel. And he's really drawn to her. And he desires to marry her. And he works 7 years to make it happen. And then comes the big night and the marriage ceremony happens. And Jacob wakes up the next day and he discovers a horrible truth. For whatever reason, we're not exactly sure why, but for whatever reason, he didn't marry Rachel last night. He married Leah, the sister. And Jacob rolls over in the morning and he looks at his bride and he says, what did I get myself into? Jacob, that happened to him the next day. But at some level, that happens to just about every couple. Where you begin and it's all love and it's all romance and you're swooning in each other's presence and all you can think about is an incredible future. Nothing could stop the two of you. And then there comes a point where just like Jacob looking at Rachel and saying, who are you? You look back at your spouse and you say, who are you? Where are the stars? Where's the romance? Where's the passion? Where is all of that eros and romance as when we met? See, eros and romance has to break down. Your marriage cannot have romance take you all the way from point one all the way till death do us part. You will change. They will change. Eros will break down. And I know how this works. You know, as soon as a couple looks at each other and there's something lacking in the relationship and they're not passionate towards each other, that's when the psychologist or Mary, the Christian counselor brings you together and tries to restrike the match of eros. And they say things like, you know, remember when you met? Remember how you fell in love? Remember how you felt about each other? They try to restrike the match of eros, but that's the problem. The eros is gone. And even if you can restrike the little match of romance, you may get it back for 30 to 60 days, but after that, you're going to go right back to where you were. At some point, every couple is going to wake up and realize that romantic love that brought them together cannot keep them together. You're asking more of romance than it can possibly give you. And so we need to reject this Eros romantic love model as the center of marriage, and we need to move towards an agape, God-centered model. And if you will build your marriage on the love of God instead of just an attraction in the other person, you'll discover more passion, more romance, and more feeling than you've ever had in your marriage. Because the agape model is not two people looking at each other. It's not two people staring back into each other's eyes saying there's just something about you that makes me drawn to you. The agape model is different. The agape model is like, as C.S. Lewis would say, it's like two people that are looking at a painting together. And as they are drawn into the painting, as they fall in love with the painting, their hearts are drawn closer and closer together. The more they're drawn to this single focal point, the more they're drawn together. And of course, as Christians, that's not a painting. It's what? That's the cross. That's a gospel, Christ-centered marriage. That's the love of God. And I'm not saying you shouldn't look into each other's eyes and fall off. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying you need to build your marriage not on a model that looks at the other person and says, I'm just going to love you for the... You need to look at God as a couple. You need to have your focal point as the cross, where you're brought together, not just because you like things about each other, but because your hearts are both in love with God. And the more you're drawn together into the cross together, the closer you are. Develop a love, not a selfish love, but when it's passionately committed to God first. And then you'll find, in a strange sort of way, your hearts are passionately committed to each other. And what I'm saying, friend, the problem in your marriage is not that you don't love your spouse enough. That's not the problem. The problem is we don't love God enough. Romans 5:5 says, the love of God has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, who has been given to us. John 1:7, if we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship one with another. You as a couple, if you will begin to cultivate a God-centered, agape love type of marriage, you will find your hearts drawn together in a way they've never been drawn together before. I rarely illustrate with my own relationship for obvious reasons, right? But, you know, I think Tina would admit we've gone through these stages, you know, where I looked at Tina and I said, wow, she's pretty. You know, I hope she's saved. I hope she's single. You know, guys go through that when you're young, you know. And she looked back and for some reason she saw something she liked in me, right? And we fell in love with each other and we couldn't stop being together. We always wanted to be together, right? And as life went on, we ended up getting married and, you know, you have 2.5 kids and a white picket fence and a dog named Spot and, you know, things like that. And we have always had a great attraction for each other. We love to be in each other's company. But I think she and I would both admit there comes a point where you look at each other and you're like, where is all the stars in the eyes? And, you know, where's the romance that was once there as life has gone on? And this is about 2 or 3 years into our marriage. And you know what we decided? We decided that we were building our marriage on kind of a romantic notion of love, not necessarily a God-centered agape kind of model that the Lord wants us to have. And we got very intentional. We said, we're going to put God first. We're going to focus on each other, yes, but we're going to put God first. We're going to make God the center of this home in every way we possibly can. We're going to read the same God-centered books together. We're both going to be in discipleship, discipling other people together. We're going to be worshiping together. We're going to have some kind of relationship and devotion together. We're going to do all we can to develop that triangle, and we're going to see if when we focus on God, how our hearts are drawn together. And I can't speak for Tina, but I can speak for myself. The more we have focused on God as the center of our relationship, I can tell you, not only do we get everything back that we had in our early marriage, we get far more than that. You get a desire for each other, a passion for each other. You want to esteem other better than self. That's not natural, friends. That only comes from the love of God shed abroad in our hearts. That's why John says, behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us. If you have a lack of passion in your marriage, the wrong thing to do is just try to rekindle the passion. The right thing to do is center your relationship on God. Center it on the cross. And let your hearts be drawn together. The more you are focused on Him, the more you are drawn together in the gospel, the more you're going to find a real passion for each other and a real love. Because the love of God is shed abroad in our hearts as we focus on Him. By the way, I just want to encourage you couples at Suba Road. You need to learn to practice spiritual disciplines together. If you're going to cultivate the agape model, if you're going to cultivate a God-centered marriage, you're going to have to really intend to do that. That doesn't happen naturally. You don't wake up one day and say, wow, you know, we both love God a whole bunch. And look how, no, you have to practice spiritual disciplines. You've got to make sure you're worshiping in a local church together. You've got to make sure you're reading the scriptures together. You've got to make sure there's some kind of prayer life going on. You got to make sure that when you get in the car, you're not just talking about the weather. You're not just talking about soccer games. You're talking about Christ. You are seasoning your entire life and your entire relationship with talk about God. That's a God-centered relationship. What you cannot do as a Christian couple is have church life over here, home life over here, sex life over here, hobby life over here. You got to find a way to season everything you do with the gospel, so that we're not just doing the God thing when we walk into the four walls here, right? And we're not just doing the God thing when we do devotions before dinner time. We're doing the God thing all the time. He is continually our focus. I told the couples at the Valentine banquet, the little illustration that I use is that of salt. And when you are, you know, when you sit down to have a meal, we had a great meal at the Valentine banquet. I had steak, and I had a potato, and I had veggies. And over here, there was a little container of salt. I didn't see anybody at the Valentine banquet take a bite of their potato and then take a piece of steak and then grab the salt shaker and do this. Nobody does that, right? What you do is you take the salt goes in everything. And we don't want to segregate our God life, our devotion life, all the way over here. We have to find ways where we're going to take that salt. We're going to take the gospel and it's going to permeate everything that we do. That's what it means to cultivate a God-centered love, where hearts are first drawn towards God and then, frankly, strangely, drawn towards each other. Now, what does it look like? What does that God-centered agape love look like? When we're focused on Him, and we're drawn to Him, and therefore a couple is drawn to each other, what is that going to look like? I could give you a lot of things, but let me give you several out of 1 Corinthians 13. Number one, it's going to be both action and attitude. Action and attitude. You notice the first part of the passage, verse 1 through 3, talks about it being the right attitude. You can do all these things, but you got to do it with the right heart. And then verse 4 that follows talks about all about the actions of love. It's patient, it's kind, it doesn't envy, it doesn't boast. That's talking about action. The first part says you got to have the right attitude. The second part says you got to have the right action. And so right off the bat, we have to say, number one, you can't have a sentimental kind of love in your marriage. You can't have one where it's all affection and it's feeling and you're looking for romance and sparks, but we're not doing the right thing by each other. Sentimental love is when a spouse says, my actions are not nearly as important as how I feel about you. If I feel good about you, if I feel like I love you, that's enough. It doesn't matter that I do the right thing. That is secular and that is sentimental. Sarah was shocked when she heard the news from her husband, Mark. Married for 3 years, had a baby. It was a neighbor. Casual conversation led to sharing intimate details. In time, they met up for lunch. Anyone from the outside looking in, the affair was inevitable. It was the day before he told his wife about the affair that he spoke with me. And he was unrepentant. He said, I plan on seeing her again. And I said, well, how do you think your wife's going to take this? And he said, she'll be crushed. I'm very concerned about that because I love her. I really want to let her know that I love her. And I've got a guy cheating on his wife, unrepentant, looking back at me going, but I love my wife. That is classic, secular, sentimental love. You can cheat on your spouse and still say you love them. You could be an unmarried couple living together and still think you're practicing biblical love. You can be an unrepentant parent who abuses a child and still says, I love them. That is sentimental. You can be a member of the community that steals and has road rage and still believe you love the community. That's sentimental. Sentimental love is marked by some feeling on the inside. The actions are unimportant. We have to reject that view. We have to reject it. Because verse 4 says, love is patient, love is kind, love does not envy. It doesn't say how you feel warm and fuzzy on the inside. It's got to make its way out to doing the right thing. So under Paul's definition, we have to reject the sentimental love. We also have to reject a religious, cold, heartless love. How many couples say things like, you know, God told me to love you, so I will love you, but I don't feel like it at all. You fulfill the covenant externally. No adultery. You're not going to practice a sin that destroys the family. You don't yell at your spouse. You'll do the right thing. But on the inside, there's indifference and maybe even hate. And so a husband goes to work to provide for his family, but it's his delight would be to spend money on a vacation with another lady. A wife goes to bed with her husband because it's the right thing, but her real delight to be with another. And I've heard people say, love is doing the right thing. I don't doubt that at all, but that's very short-sighted. Because if I'm reading the text right, it says, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, though I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, though I do all these good things, though I give to the poor, verse 3, though I give my body to be burned, that's talking about martyrdom, though I do all these right actions, if I don't have the right heart attitude, I'm a zero. And let me make an application, friend. Anytime we do the right thing for the wrong reason, the solution is never to stop doing the right thing. The solution is always to bring your heart in line with the truth. I recall the very first time I had a confrontation with a person. They were leaving their spouse for another person. And I sat down. It was myself. A couple other pastors were involved. And we sat across from a man who was running from God. And he said, my heart is not in it. My heart's not in it. I don't love her. I don't hate her. I don't have anything against her. I'm very indifferent. And he was setting me up for a line that I would hear, I think, 200 times since he said this. He looked back at me and said, are you saying that I should stay in a marriage if my heart is not in it? Do you think God wants us to do things if our heart is not in them? Do you want me to be a hypocrite? I should have known this was coming. So I looked back at him and I said, actually, yes, I think God wants you to be a hypocrite. And you're giving me two lame options. I'll pick the best one of the two. Yeah, I think you should be a hypocrite. And then I went on to explain to him the right thing to do by God and by the gospel is not to quit doing the right thing. It's to get your heart in line with the right thing. Look at the Old Testament sacrifices. You know, when Israel was bringing a good sacrifice but doing it without the right heart, God never says, stop bringing me those sacrifices. He didn't say that. He says, get your heart in line with the right sacrifice. The answer is never to quit doing the right thing. The answer is to get your heart in line with the right thing. Love is both an action and an attitude. Let's talk about love a little bit. We'll go as far as we can, okay? Number one, love enlarges the boundaries of our patience. It enlarges the love of our boundaries of our patience. Love is patient and love is kind. God's love for us is patient and kind. We know that. What does this mean? It means you need to resist that needless moment of conflict over minor annoyances. Overlook irritations. It means at some point, stop trying to change your spouse into your own image and start loving them. Listen, I'm all for challenging each other in marriage. I'm probably going to bring a message about confrontation and things like that. So I'm okay challenging each other. If he's a bit sloppy, it drives you crazy, you let him know. You know, she's a bit late, it annoys me, it reflects poorly upon, so you confront her. I'm okay confronting on those little annoyances, but I do think there comes a point, right, where you have to ask yourself the question, am I really going to let this minor annoyance destroy my marriage? And I've said it before, I'll say it again. Every happy, healthy, loving marriage that I know of, at some point, they made a decision to stop trying to change each other and start loving each other. You might look at me and say, Pastor, I've got an issue with my spouse. They are, you know, they never follow through with what they tell me they're going to do. First of all, we already talked about never use the word never, but let's get past that. They make, you know, little promises, little action to back it up. It drives me crazy. And I constantly tell them, remind them, she drops the ball, he drops the ball. This has been a cycle in our marriage for 15 years. Number one, I am not justifying their negligence. But I do think there comes a point where you got to say, you know, God loves me when I'm negligent, and I'm going to love my spouse when they're negligent. My spouse constantly cuts me off when we're in conversation. They always feel like they have to get the last word, even when we're not in a dispute. He's loud, he's abrasive, he seems to just cut right in. I've told him a million times, and he just doesn't see it. I think at some point, you got to say, it looks like I'm going to have to glorify God by loving a loud person. My husband can't even keep the same job. My wife can't keep the same job. Every 2 years, they get a new get-rich-quick scheme. She quits her job, right? Buys into something new, drags us into it. It's very irresponsible, and I would say it sounds pretty irresponsible to me, too. But, you know, at some point, you've got to say, I guess God's called me to love an irresponsible person. And the question is it really worth destroying your marriage over this? I am not at all against confrontation. You should know that. There's a right time, there's a right place. But if the minor annoyance is going to spiral to destroy the marriage, you've got to ask yourself the question, is that really worth it? So number one, it pushes, it enlarges the boundaries of patience. Love also does not parade itself around. It does not envy, it does not boast. When something good happens to your spouse, you're not envious, you're grateful. Job promotions, graduations, weight loss, all the things we rejoice over. We rejoice with those that rejoice. There are some in the church at Corinth, they desired certain gifts, they didn't have those. They rivaled each other, strife ensued. And one of the things all of us need to ask, when you and your spouse are speaking, are you your favorite topic? And sometimes it's even a woe is me, right? Woe is me. I always have a horrible day. The worst things always happen to me. That's still you making yourself the center of the relationship. You just love to come home and unload and drag them into all the woes. There's a time to weep with those that weep. We're not denying that at all. But are you your favorite topic of conversation? Number three, love does not belittle your spouse so that you may feel more important. It is not arrogant. You know, William Carey, the missionary, was at dinner once, and someone said very sarcastically, he said, Mr. Carey, I heard you were once a shoemaker. And he looked back and said, no, sure, I was not a shoemaker. I was a shoe repair man, you know, one step down. And I like that, you know, taking the seedy humility. How many husbands and wives put each other down in order to fill some void they have in their own lives? You feel like a failure at work, so you come home and take it out on your family. You don't like the way life is going, so you belittle your spouse, and that makes you feel more powerful and in control. You have some problem with self-image or something like that, and you take it out on everybody around you in the house. When insulted, we should bear the shame that Jesus bore for us. Love exercises wisdom regarding the boundaries of what is crude. Verse 5, it is not rude. The old King James does not behave itself unseemingly. Love does not make crude comments, doesn't do crude things. You know, if the question is not, am I sinning? That's only one question. Sometimes a husband and a wife will do something and it's really disrupting the home. And they'll look back at the other person and say, what are you saying? Are you saying I'm in sin? That's just one question. It does not behave itself unseemingly. There's a wisdom here that needs to come into the relationship. Is it helpful? Is my action profitable? Is my comment contributing or tearing down? Love moves beyond the borders of your own wants and needs. It does not insist on having its own way, Paul says. Nothing to be done through strife and vainglory. But I love the old King James on this. It says, love seeketh not her own. Now, hear this carefully. Love seeketh not her own. Think of that word, seeketh. The Greek word is zeteo. It means to actively pursue, to seek. Remember in Ecclesiastes 7 where Solomon says, I pursued or I sought after wisdom. He sought after wisdom, right? He made a decision. I'm going to seek wisdom. Job 39:8 talks about a donkey that zeteos. It searches after food there in the green pasture. It's not just that you put your spouse's interest above your own. You're seeking to do it. That's what this text is saying. You are plotting. You are planning. You are downright scheming how you can put their interest above your own. Love seeketh not her own. Looking for new and crafty ways to push aside your own agenda for the good of the family, for the good of the spouse. Love views your words and actions in the best possible light. It thinketh no evil, not irritable, not resentful. Now let's be clear, love is not naive. Love does not turn a blind eye to sin. It doesn't turn a blind eye to the obvious. Love doesn't catch your spouse in adultery and say, you know, I guess they're just having a bad day, you know. Love doesn't close eyes to the obvious. Having said that, love gives the benefit of the doubt. Love doesn't think your husband is into some pretty lady at the office just because he might be. And love doesn't think your wife is saying something mean behind your back because she did it 10 years ago and obviously she still does it today. Love gives the benefit of the doubt. I love the in the book of Acts where Paul becomes a Christian. And the Christian community is so suspicious. They don't want anything to do with him. And he can't seem to get into the church there to minister and become a part of it. And Barnabas reaches out and takes Paul by the hand and takes him in. What a contrast there between a very suspicious church that doesn't give the benefit of the doubt and Barnabas who does. Love takes an inventory of the graces in your spouse. When you look at your spouse under the lens of this agape love, it's not looking at all the failures and all the faults and all the problems. It's not saying, you know, they never pick up, they're always late, they always say the wrong thing at the wrong time, they always embarrass me in front of people. It's not looking at people through the worst possible light. It's looking at their words and actions through the best possible light. Love is not taking an inventory of all the annoyances. Love is taking an inventory of the graces. This is a simple exercise, and I mean simple. But let me give you a small exercise that will revolutionize your marriage. And I don't use that word lightly. You begin to take an inventory of the graces of your spouse. Just ask yourself this question. What do they do well? And don't make it one of these backhanded things. You know what I mean? Like every time they're late to a meeting, I like that they do this. No, that's backhanded. You know what I mean, right? Take an inventory of what they do well. Put it down on a piece of paper. Take an inventory of the graces. Don't just do it one day. Do it for an entire month. And refer back to that little inventory that you've created. What is it that God is doing in their life? What are the gifts that God has given them? Yeah, they may not be this logical, mathematical thinker, right? And that may annoy you a little bit. But isn't it wonderful how they reach out to people that are in need? And they may not have the biggest heart for mercy, but isn't it awesome how they love to help people understand the gospel? We don't all have all the gifts. Which gifts does your spouse have? Take an inventory of those graces. Love does all that it can to rid the marriage and the home of sin. Verse 6. Text tells us here it does not rejoice in wrongdoing. Now, what does that mean? It rejoices in good things. It rejoices in the truth. That doesn't mean that you necessarily have control over everything in your home. I realize that. You can't always control what's on the TV, what's on the radio. You can't always control every conversation that goes around the house. But that which is under your control, love does all it can to rid the marriage and the home of sin. In other words, a loving spouse is going to be careful about what's being seen and what's being heard. A loving spouse will be careful about the conversation. A loving spouse is going to walk into the house and do silent treatment or blow up and say things they regret. And the last one is this. Love says, I will never leave you or forsake you. That's what God says to us, and that's what verse 7 teaches. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Love is willing to fight for the love of your spouse, like Hosea going after Gomer. Love puts up with a lot. Friend, there is never a day in your marriage where you're not called to be willing. And this means that love is being willing to have your life complicated by the needs and struggle of your husband or wife. Think that through. If I love the person, I am willing to have my life complicated by them. Their actions affect me. Their words affect me. Their spending habits affect me. All that the other person does in marriage. And this is what makes it unique from other relationships. Because that guy across the street, he may complicate your life, but nowhere to the degree that your spouse can complicate your life. Love is willing to have your life complicated by your spouse. Because Jesus had his life terribly complicated by ours. I mean, if ever there was a man that broke into our sorrows and had his life complicated by our sin and complicated by our annoyances and complicated by all the things that we could possibly do wrong, it was God himself. But Jesus said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Even when you complicate my life, I will still love you. And love looks back and says the same thing. Even when you complicate my life, I will love you. Let me tell you, if you're having trouble in your marriage, if when you look at each other, you know, something's not there. If you're like what we talked about in the beginning, there's a serious limp problem in your relationship. And you've just learned to deal with that. Let me tell you, the best thing you can do is get along with your spouse tonight, look them dead in the eye and say, just so you know, I'm never going to leave you or forsake you. Just so you know. Run? You can't possibly run out of my life. Sin? You can't sin your way out of my life. I'll never leave or forsake you. Let that kind of love and that grace-centered marriage be a part of what you're cultivating in your home. Are we building relationships just on that romantic model? Or are we building them upon the love of God? If we build on that romance model, friend, they're not going to last. You build upon that agape model, you get all the romance and more. And that's what the Word teaches us here at 1 Corinthians 13. Let's close with prayer.